11:55. Almost midnight. Enough time for one more story. One more story before 12. Just to keep us warm.
All right, Nathan, here we are, around the campfire, not singing Kumbaya, which I'm so excited about, but getting ready to dig into some urban legends.
You're excited about not singing Kumbaya? I'm excited about not singing Kumbaya, too.
Nice.
If we had some Vienna sausages on sticks now, that would be the ultimate thing. Or some
chip,
of those...
Chip beef on toast?
I like chip beef on toast. My children, if they hadn't eaten them, we could have those big fist-sized marshmallows I make now.
Oh, yeah.
You know, burn great. It so it looks like a cocoon on the outside.
Put that on a big old graham cracker with... Oh, dude...
Yeah,
now I'm getting hungry. Man, we might have to pause this to go get some s'mores.
Yeah, some campfire chili.
But no, super excited, and we're going to get to that in just a second. First of all, we want to welcome everybody back to Pop Culture Ninja. And we want to let everyone know that we did do the announcement of our winners, and I have received now all of the addresses, the physical addresses from the winners. So you can expect your comic books to be going out within this next week here. So this is being released just before Halloween. So the week of Halloween, that first week going into November, you can expect those to be sent off to you.
Now, did you bring up the fact that all of the comics we originally had have been burned up in the fire? So they've had to be replaced with My Little Pony comics.
My Little Pony, Transformers.
Yes, yes. Now, if you're someone out there who just got more excited because I mentioned those titles, I'm making this all up. So it's the wonders of radio.
That's right. So yeah, you guys can expect those coming out, and we're looking forward to it. But today, we are talking about the urban legend, and we're actually going to...
The campfire story.
Yeah, the campfire story. We're going to get to some of those in a little bit. But Nathan, let's talk about what makes the campfire the perfect place for the scary story. It's funny because different people have these different images, but I think everyone would agree that the campfire is the ultimate setting for the perfect ghost story, the perfect urban legend, to just get you kind of, woo, the chills coming up and down your spine. And let's talk about that for a little bit. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, and that is a great image, everyone around the campfire. If you even think back, I always approach everything from the movie perspective, but if you think back over some of the movies we've had, I remember in the 80s a Carpenter movie called The Fog. It was not originally intended to be the opening of the film, but there's a great opening of the film with an old man, and he's got a bunch of these kids down by the seaside around the fire, and he's essentially telling the story that become about these ghostly pirates.
Yeah.
Becomes the plot of the film, and it's probably the best scene in the movie.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of movies that start that way. Even a few years ago, the movie Cloud Atlas, the sci-fi movie Cloud Atlas, begins with Tom Hanks around a campfire. And I think one of the reasons it's the perfect setting is because at a certain point in time, it was probably the only available setting. Mm. Not the only one, but if you think about the way that stories are told and whatnot, and when stories are told, that around a fire, around what would be the community gathering, regardless of whether you're in a tent or depending on where you're at, you probably end up being around a fire. It's going to be whatever the community gathering center is. Yeah. That's obviously changed. We'll probably talk about that because the community gathering center is now sort of online, and that's where legends and stories and whatnot seem to be established now. But I think that for a very long time, the campfire was the primary way to tell stories. And when we started telling stories in other ways, and certainly you and I have always... and people, our parents, always lived in a world where there were other avenues and ways to tell stories. So the campfire story was a little bit rarefied, meaning it was a special kind of experience. You go out as a part of a scout troop, or you go out in the woods, or maybe you're camping with your parents and you're there and you're telling stories. There were so many more sophisticated ways to tell stories that I think we now associate the campfire story with the very simplistic way. The kinds of stories that end up being told around a campfire are usually pretty simple. They're almost the equivalent of like a joke. In a sense that a joke has a build-up and a punchline, but not too much build-up, and the punchline's got to be kind of strong or otherwise it's a bad joke.
Yeah. Yeah.
Some people find value in that too, but
yeah, and I think there's something to the vulnerability of a campfire, because if you think about it, you know, you have in this one setting the lights in the center, and it's projecting out, so you have all the shadows behind you. You know, you can't see something coming up behind you. Your back is to the woods or the water or whatever it might be. And so there's a vulnerability in those stories where somebody can, you know, come up and sneak up behind you and, you know, grab you and scare you, you know, during the height of the story, which, you know, you see in almost any movie where they are sitting around the campfire telling those stories. You know, you always have the crazy friend who's coming up behind and, you know, scaring the other guy. And there's something to that.
I think that's a really good point, because one of the, as we were talking and establishing this, one of the things that we were starting to do with the Phantom Galaxy podcast is look at myths and legends and things in general. Mm-hmm. But the campfire story does sit apart from, we're not talking about just oral tradition here. We're specifically talking the campfire story. And you're right. The campfire story very rarely tends to be a romantic comedy. Mm-hmm. It very rarely tends to be just a story about how your day is going. It really doesn't mm-hmm. even tend to be a story about a mythical hero doing something great. It usually is a horror story or a cautionary story.
Yeah.
Or some kind of story that's really supposed to put you on edge or at attention or at alert. Like, it's not intended to be, it can be a form of relaxation, but it's not, no one sits down and tells a story about, hey, you remember the time Aunt Gladys made those brownies, unless yeah. those brownies had glass in them and three kids went to the hospital. You know, it's not a kind of story that usually doesn't have a sense of tension to it, and that's probably because of what you're saying. Like, in that setting, it lends itself very well to stories we might not tell each other any other time.
Yeah.
Like, around a fire out in the woods. And when a lot of these stories begin in such a way where you're like, it happened to my cousin's neighbor, yes. whatever. Like, yes. it's, there's a sense of, like, a confessional. Everybody's around. No one's around, but everyone in this inner circle has, you know, the attention. The storyteller has everyone's attention.
Yeah.
There's a sense of confidence there. So these stories that start to come out, I think the campfire is probably one of the many areas, but there's probably other settings yes. as well. And this is probably a very good primer, this sort of thing, for why things like movies came to prominence. Because again, you've got a darkened place where everyone's there,
yeah.
and you have the attention. The outside world falls away because you can't see it, in a sense. And so the storyteller, the theater actor, the filmmaker has your attention, like, right away.
Yeah. Yeah, no, and before we get any further, I'd like to just kind of read this definition of the urban myth, because I think it encompasses so much of what we're going to be talking about today. And it's interesting, because whenever I think of the urban myth, the urban legend, whatever you want to call it, the ghost story, you and I were talking before we signed on to this podcast and saying, you know, I bet that you have specific ones to your region, because you grew up here in Maryland and I grew up in New Hampshire. And it's true, we both have these various ones. A lot of them, for me, were centered and focused around the witches, Salem witch trial. Growing up in New Hampshire, Salem was, you know, maybe hour and a half away from my house. And so a lot of those kind of stem from that I heard growing up, a witch in some form or another.
Yeah, but do you have the Blair Witch?
No, thankfully.
Neither do we, really.
Yeah, I know. So let me just kind of read these real quick. So an urban legend or a popular legend, urban myth, urban tale, contemporary legend, is a form of modern folklore consisting of fictional stories, often with the macabre elements deeply rooted in local popular culture. These legends can be used for entertainment purposes as well as for semi-serious explanations for random events such as disappearances and strange objects, which, as we'll talk about, will encompass some of these stories that we're going to mention. You know, a group of 10 people mysteriously disappeared. Well, you know, it was mysteriously disappeared because, let's say, I heard about these 10 people that disappeared. And so I came up with this story to explain the disappearance, but the reality is all 10 of those people came back. I just didn't hear about their reemerging through that process.
Yeah, I think a very easy to pinpoint example is crop circles.
Yes.
That's a much larger level, but crop circles, we all have a pretty good idea now of how those crop circles originate. We have people come forward and say, mm-hmm. hey, this is how I did it. And again, like the clowns that are appearing now. But the crop circles took on a dimension where they very much belong. It doesn't matter that most of us know now that they are fictional and made up. They very much belong to UFO mythology
yes.
now, to alien mythology. As we continue to tell stories, whether they're purposeful entertainment stories or there's people out there who still sort of, and there are always people out there who still subscribe to this stuff, that conspiracy theories and everything, there's some of those people are still insistent that the crop circles belong to part yes. of this mythology. I mean, X-Files, when it opened up on television, you know, the images of the crop circles. That whole element was created to explain something, but then it became such an entrenched part of mythology that it exists outside of the crop circle. The explanation yeah. doesn't matter anymore because we know that the reason that it was there has nothing to do.
And we're going to talk about this closer when we get to Christmas, but Santa Claus, as a legend, as a myth, has been perpetuated throughout history, and then his alter ego, Krampus,
In a similar sense, yeah. Krampus is getting all the publicity now, but it's taken him a while to climb into the spotlight. He's like the lesser-known Hemsworth brother. But in what's going or what has happened with storytelling is legends or even icons that we're very familiar with now at one time were just a story.
Mm-hmm.
And what I think will be interesting is when we start to get to you telling your regional story, my telling my regional story, talking to anybody and asking about something that happened in an area where they grew up, it's not that surprising to learn that most of these stories are the same story. The Phantom Hitchhiker is ridiculously busy. He, she, whoever must keep just traveling back and forth across the country because they're everywhere.
Yeah.
You know, and the same thing. How many people found rats in KFC chicken? I'm guessing yes. zero. Over time, it's happened everywhere.
Yes.
And we talked a little bit about the whole Satanists in the 80s mm-hmm. and the razor blade candy without, you know, people can take candy to a hospital and get it x-rayed
yeah.
with there being no actual documented case yeah. of razor blades ever ending up in candy. So it's very interesting. That's kind of where I'm interested in is why do these stories exist? Why tell them? Is it healthy to tell stories and ghost stories and things of that nature? In reality, they all exist sort of outside of belief in ghosts or yeah. supernatural oogity-boogity things.
Yeah.
It's just another form of myth-making.
Yeah. No, and I agree 100%. I think there's a level of community that we are missing today with a lot of these things transferring online, with, you know, the posts and the forums and the this and the that. We're missing something about gathering together with friends, family, even strangers, and sitting around a campfire and being able to share this experience.
Most are not strangers that escape from a mental asylum and have a hook for a hand.
Yeah.
You got to check that when they sit down next to the fire.
Absolutely.
Like, show me your hands.
That's right.
And both of your feet.
Make sure they don't have a machete or something with them. But yeah, but there's something that's being missed with that general. And we talked about this in the These Go to 11 Halloween podcast where, you know, both or all three of us, you, Greg, and myself, we're anxious and excited to be experiencing that level of community that Halloween can bring out. And I think the campfire, the ghost story, brings another level of community that we just don't see anymore. And so, you know, it's something that I would love to see come back again. You know, that level of, hey, you know, let's all go camping, you know, 10 of us and hang out in the woods.
Big couch and sit out in the middle of the woods, like the Midnight Society.
That's right.
What was that? Are You Afraid of the Dark?
Yes.
That show. I was kind of beyond that at a point when it came on TV. I was, I think, going into high school, so I wasn't. My siblings watched it. But what a great idea to have that sort of anthology show that the wraparound story is kids sitting on a couch in the middle of the woods and they have to tell the stories to be a part of the group. I thought that was always cool. But hey, let's like jump into it.
Yeah, I you know,
how about you growing up? You had a favorite story?
Yeah, it's interesting because like I said, most of the stories that I heard are probably they're probably ones that are very universal. So you had like Bloody Mary, you know, and the whole myth behind Bloody Mary is, you know, you go into a room, shut the lights out, and, you know, look in a mirror and say Bloody Mary five times and she's going to come and scratch your eyeballs out. Supernatural actually did an episode with Bloody Mary.
Yeah, Supernatural, their first season, hit a lot of the urban legends right up front. And of course, there's a very popular horror movie from the 90s called Candyman.
Yes.
Where Clive Barker adapted that idea of the ghost or the figment that you say the name and it comes out of the mirror. But he kind of did it from perspective of, what does that guy do when he's not coming out of the mirror and killing you? Does he have a whole life? Where did he come from and what is he doing? Not that we ever saw Candyman working at the grocery store.
That's
or anything.
Right.
Although, about 3 or 4 years ago, we were, Jen and myself were with her aunt, who's a huge horror fan, and we were sitting at Corner Stable in Towson, and my Jen's cousin gets sort of almost like freaked out. And she's looking up, and she's looking up, and I look up and I'm like, what's going on? You think you see the Candyman, don't you? And she goes, yes. And I said, well, that's him. And she looks around and she goes, it is. And yes, Tony Todd, the actor who played Candyman, was like devouring a bloomin' onion or whatever, you know, right across the horror convention was in town. So he and Ernie Hudson from Ghostbusters and Barbara Crampton and a few others were all at this table. And I was like, oh, this is great. But they were terrified because in their mind, this was the Candyman. I mean, he's wearing overalls. Tony Todd's super nice, friendly guy. Nothing at all. You know, he's not going to stab you with a hook.
Right.
And but they couldn't get beyond that. And I watched the waitress walk up to him, sort of like get his order. Terrified me my entire life. You know, what do you say to that? Thank you.
I've done my job.
So it's So in a sense, horror movies are our campfire stories now. But the killer with the hook,
The vanishing hitchhiker, which you brought up.
The Lover's Lane kind of stories. Yeah. I think that's kind of disassociated from us a little bit because I've never really had any Lover's Lane experience.
Yeah.
And I don't think that was something that like it was typically happening as much. You know, that's more of a thing of the 1950s. You know, to me, it's a little creepy now to imagine a bunch of people all sitting. It seems like it would kill the mood. But do you have all those cars in a line? But, you know, in that story, the monster is always haunting some kind of place where you would almost, you don't want to be you don't want to be found out in a scenario like that. You know, a lot of the when creatures haunt a specific place or a ghost haunts a specific place, it's sometimes that kind of area where, like you said, the vulnerability. Yes. The vulnerability, okay, you're in a car, and if something bad happens to you here, you're sort of caught in the midst of your, from the 1950 perspective, you're caught in the midst of your sin or the midst of doing something. And so a lot of times the monster, the ghost, whatever, is a lot of urban legends still tend to be morality tales that the supernatural force is sort of catching you in a moment of weakness, vulnerability, the babysitter who gets caught in the house.
Yes.
And the phone rings, and then she, which was a minute ago, the phone rang here, it was going off, and I mean, we missed a real opportunity. He's still in the house. You know, do you remember, are you familiar with the story? This particular story, there's a girl who goes to bed every night, and she has her, to make sure that everything is safe, her dog sort of is under her bed, so she'll come into the room. And I suppose in the sense of, sometimes the lights are off, sometimes the girl's blind, that she is reaching her hand under to be reassured by the fact that the dog is licking her hand, and she knows that everything is safe. So she goes in, she puts her hand under the bed, she hears a noise, she's concerned, but when she goes to the bed and lays down, puts her hand under there, the dog licks her hand. And when she goes into the room, into the bathroom, flips on the light, in the version where she has sight, she sees the dog's head is essentially laying there, and there's something on the wall that says something like, you know, you should have looked under the bed.
Yeah, or something like
that. And the idea is that the guy is under the bed and he's licked her hand. That's a creepy kind of gross story. But it does harken back to that sensibility of the vulnerable,
yes.
of getting you in a place where your rational mind isn't thinking. Like,
yes.
the person who tells you the story in front of the fire wants you to go back home and think about that thing.
Yes.
When you're sitting alone you by yourself. Yes.
Yes.
Not for any safety reason, but just because the idea is to freak you out, is
yes.
to make you think about it a little bit later. And if you're thinking about that story, in a sense, the storyteller has achieved a little bit of immortality because they've influenced you in some way.
Yes. Yeah, and, you know, it's interesting because I'm looking at some of these, again, more universal myths, and some of them fascinate me because I find them intriguing from the perspective of a guy who does self-defense, who teaches self-defense to others. And so, you know, I'm looking at this one, you know, checking the back seat of your car, you know, and there's the whole urban myth that, you know, of course, it's always, you know, it's always a single girl who's, you know, driving a long distance home and, you know, she gets out of the car and pumps gas and she has to run into the bathroom or something for a minute. And, you know, she finishes up, gets back in and drives off. And there's a person who's in the back of the car ready to hack her head off. Or, you know, I never understood that part of the myth, because if you're driving down the highway doing 50 miles an hour, from the perspective of a killer, why are you going to chop someone's head off that's going to cause the car to, like, spin out of control and kill you as well as this person?
You're out of your mind. You don't care. You just want to see someone's head roll into the front seat. The secondary aspect of that story, which I think is important too, and it's been used in a lot of movies, mm-hmm. and when they made, in the 90s, when they ran out of reasons to make slasher movies, they did Urban Legends,
yes.
which is maybe one of the laziest movies
yes.
I've ever seen, because they just took all these Urban Legends and slapped them onto a slasher movie.
Yes.
But that movie opened up with a version of this, and essentially, the other aspect is, not only is the killer in the back seat, but what actually happens is when the whoever this person is, but you're right, tends to be a young female, which doesn't really matter. If a guy
right.
in the backseat with an axe is going to cut your head off either way, it doesn't matter. I mean, you could be the self-defense instructor. If you don't
That's
get
right.
around in enough time, your head's coming off.
That's right.
So she's driving along, whoever this person is driving along, and what they start to see is the high beams flashing them
yes.
from the back, and there's a car who's
yes.
kind of like tailgating them. And that's a very easy to understand kind of fear, that idea you're on the road. And I think we've all probably had that experience where someone late at night is following you too close,
yes.
and you almost wait to see, are they going to follow me? And oh, they did turn.
Yes.
And then they've turned again. And I one time had that happen, and it was a friend of mine who had become, who lived nearby and had become aware and was just following me home to mess, you know, you got to
yes.
mess with me. When it pulls into your own parking,
yes.
into your,
yes.
your parking lot, and you don't realize that you know them, it's a little disconcerting.
That's right.
But as the high beams flash, she becomes more and more concerned. And, of course, the concern is related to the car behind,
yes.
behind her. And eventually, when she's finally flagged or she finally pulls over, the person who is chasing her down reveals that, well, every time I flash my high beams, there
yes.
was a guy coming up behind you getting ready to stab you,
right.
and I flash the lights. And in some of the versions, it ends with her pulling into the gas station,
yeah.
and then the gas station attendant sort of like yanks her out of the car, and she's convinced that this deranged killer now has her, but he's
right.
yanking her out of the car because he sees
he's
the guy in the back seat.
Right.
It does encourage me to clean my back seat, because there's times when I have enough trash back there. I'm like, conceivably someone could actually lay under this. I don't know why you would want to lay under all of that trash, but you technically could hide in my back seat at this point. So
yeah.
try to keep that. I think that's a good rule of thumb.
That's right. Now, the other kind of myth with the high beams is somebody's driving down the road toward you and they don't have their lights on, so you flash your high beams and they, you know, they turn their lights on and start following you. This is some sort of gang initiation associated with this particular urban myth. Have you ever heard that one before?
Not as familiar, but I'm assuming that's kind of a newer thing. Do we know, do we have an origination for that? Or
yeah, that's a good question. Give me one second. Let me, so let's see. It looks like this urban legends claim that upon flashing your lights at the car with no headlights, you make yourself a target for gang members. They will chase you down and shoot at your car. For this reason, it's best to refrain from flashing your lights. So there's no initial, you know.
There's a very simple one. And I think that's the other kind. You have the one where there's a story where there's always a character. And the character has to be related in some way. Like, again, my aunt's uncle told me this story. There's always some kind of connection, though it usually is very vague about where the story came from.
Yes.
And when you hear the story, there's no way it ever happened, but you're sort of freaked out about it.
Right.
And
although what's interesting is with this particular story and all the accounts of road rage that we have, I could actually see something like this happening in today's society with, you know, people and cars and vehicles, and you hear all sorts of strange things that people are doing today with vehicles and, you know.
And I think you've kind of tapped into something. You've stumbled across something there that I think is that the very base of the urban legend is, with some of the stories we're telling right now don't seem very plausible. Mm. But I think at the time an urban legend or campfire story comes into being, it comes into being and it becomes popular because at the moment it occurs, there's a plausibility to it. Yeah. Sometimes because we just don't know enough about a certain thing to know better.
Yeah.
Like right now, this sounds plausible because we see crazy things happen.
Yes.
We also live in a culture that's a little different in the sense that we bring urban legends to life.
Yes.
Like, when we hear a story, we decide, why haven't people been dressing up as clowns and standing on the edge of playgrounds? Well, I haven't ever done that before. You know, and we'll talk a little bit later about the Slender Man, which is a internet sort of confabulation that kind of went tragic in a few cases. But in a story like that, it seems plausible. Now, why did some of these other stories seem plausible? Because at the time that they sprang up, the killer in the back seat, for example, you're right. If you think about it a little bit, it doesn't make sense. But imagine the level of vulnerability. This girl has no phone. She has no way to contact anybody.
Yes.
In the 70s, the 60s, 70s, or the 80s, when these stories are popping up, she is basically at the mercy of the people she encounters, the person on the road. She can only run away or drive away. And what happens when the car runs out of gas? What happens? These sort of things. We are inoculated against that a little bit these days. You know, that we feel like, oh, well, we've got a phone. We've got this. We've got the car. But I think the heart of both of those stories still comes with that sense of what happens when I'm at the mercy of a stranger.
Yes.
And what do I do in that situation? And so the high beams thing, it's all, and the element of the unknown where who's in that other car is a creepy thing at night. The high beam is obscured. You can't even see what kind of car it is. You don't know if it's your friend messing with you or if it's someone who really intends to do you harm. 9 times out of 10, road rage happens in the middle of the day, most cases, you know, or during rush hour.
Yes.
It probably doesn't typically happen, but when your irrational brain kicks in, you know that you're going to be that one statistic. You're going to be that guy or girl that, like, they're going to tell stories about me.
That's right.
I was stupid and I got killed.
Legend.
Yes, exactly. But I think a good example of this, like the not knowing better, do you remember in the 80s, there was a big popular urban legend about the girl who puts her head in the microwave to dry her hair and cooks her brains?
Because didn't they do that one also in that movie, Urban Legend, but they did it with a dog?
Oh, was there a dog? There was a movie from the late 90s. Okay, there's a movie. This is a good piece of trivia. There's a movie from the very early 90s called The Willies. And it has Sean Astin in it. But it also has a cameo by Kirk Cameron. Not a Christian film, but playing his Growing Pains character who starts to talk to whatever characters in the movie, you know, through the TV. That starts set around a campfire, and they do a lot of little vignettes at the beginning. One of them is a lady microwaving her poodle to dry it off with horrible results. The one that I never understood was the girl putting her whole head in the microwave because how do you close the door?
I know.
You know, like, the microwaves don't really work that way.
Right.
But in the very, when the microwaves first showed up, there's a sense of, well, what does it really do?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I'm not going to try to microwave my head because what happens if I can?
Yes. There's one that I can remember growing up hearing, and this takes place in early history, where you know, people would fall into comas, and because, you know, hospitals and those types of places were smaller back then, what they used to do is pre-dig the grave, and they would place people in the grave, and they would put a bell hanging down, you know, and the whole myth goes, you know, when that person wakes up, the bell would go off and people would hear it, and they would go down, dig up the person, and, you know, bring them out. And so, you know, this particular myth continues where they woke up the next day, went down, and realized that the string had been cut or this had been broken on the bell. So they dig the person up, and you have the scratch marks on the inside of the wood coffin, and, you know, all, playing on people's fears of being buried alive and alone.
And I think, too, this goes back to that thing about the plausibility. You and I are sitting here thinking about it, and there's a part of my mind that's saying, you know, that probably might have happened a couple times. Yeah,
that'd be like, make sure I'm really dead before you bury me.
And if not, can you make my, like, coffin out of, like, balsa wood so I can scratch out of it? That's a good reason to get some good upper arm strength, because I have to Kill Bill style burrow my way out of the tomb. That's why you study martial arts. Punch your way out of the grave.
No, I told Joy, I said, you know what, if I'm dead or you think I'm dead, you're cremating me, because I don't want to wake up like that.
I know. Well, it's like someone's like, I've always been afraid of worms. You won't need worms where you're going. Well, there's another variation, not on that story, but there's a story that I remember, and I remember spooking me out, because in the 80s, it was very popular to take all this junk and stick it in children's books. Yeah. You know, did you remember the scary stories to tell in the dark?
Yes.
Alvin Schwartz had the most horrifying illustrations I've ever seen. And about 6 or 7 years ago, somebody decided that we needed to make the illustrations less scary. So they got somebody to do illustrations, and they're terrible. They're not nearly as good. But if you look up scary stories to tell in the dark, half the times those illustrations, I think they were Stephen Gimmel's illustrations, they don't look anything like the story they're being told, but the images have stuck into my head to this day. They're terrifying.
Yes.
But one of these stories, I distinctly remember reading it, where this young boy, young girl, I don't think it really matters, but they are sort of taunted by their friends to go up to a certain hillside cemetery, stand on a grave, and stick their knife, plunge the knife, the pen knife, into the ground. And you won't do this because you know old man so-and-so, who was a terrible, terrible person, is going to spring out of the grave and grab you.
Yes.
And he'll pull you down. And so they go up to the grave. And I remember reading the story and being really freaked out. And, of course, when you're reading a story in a book, you can always stop. So the moment when they plunge the knife into the ground, that's when he realizes that something has him by the leg and will not let him go. Yes. And he goes to run, and I'm like, I'm done. And I put the book down, which was a horrible choice, because if I had thought about the story, I should have seen where it was going. But this was, I was very young. And so I walk away and let my mind unravel all kinds of horrible scenarios of this guy dragging this child down into the ground and everything. Yes. And of course, his friends found him the next day, and he's dead. He's died of fright because he stuck the penknife down into his pants leg, and he couldn't get away. And, you know, I guess freaked out, didn't bother to look down, and so now he's dead. Yeah. Again, there's a certain element of dark humor to a lot of these stories, but that kind of always encouraged me to either do one of two things. Finish the story, or read the end first.
That's right. That's funny. Let's go ahead and talk about the Slender Man, or the Slender Man for a little bit, and then talk about some of our more local ones, because, you know, I was doing a little bit of research, and there's a couple that I remember as a younger child being more localized. Most of the ones we've been talking about have been more universal. These are more universal, and some of them have some kind of local twist to them, but, you know, these are known all around the world. For the most part, and then
New Jersey has the Jersey Devil, the Jersey Turnpike.
Dante's Seventh Circle. Right,
who has the Phantom Kangaroo?
Ooh, that's a good question. Let me check that. So the Phantom Kangaroo is fascinating because typically,
besides the fact it's a Phantom Kangaroo,
exactly. Yes. So typically, this revolves around some kind of, you know, sighting of a kangaroo that invokes mass hysteria.
And it's hopping everywhere!
Exactly! And so what you're finding is,
carrying a bomb in its pouch.
Right. Terrorist! So what it is it's mostly where in places where kangaroos don't occur naturally.
So Australia has no phantom kangaroos.
Exactly.
Although you would assume that Australia would have more phantom kangaroos because it has more dead kangaroos.
I think part of it is because people in Australia, they're exposed to kangaroos. They know what one looks like, so they're not going to mistake it for something else.
They're more, you know, Australia has its own problems with the drop bears, which we can talk about later, you know. Forget the kangaroos. It's the murderous koalas dropping on your head that are the problem.
That's what you need to worry about. So most interestingly, though, the United States has had several of these sightings, the earliest one documented in 1934 near South Pittsburgh.
That's where they would go, Pittsburgh.
Exactly, right? I mean, and then in Tennessee. So, you know, you have Pittsburgh and you have Tennessee. Those are the redneck kangaroos. So the way this goes is there was a kangaroo or a kangaroo-like beast.
Something not quite a kangaroo.
That's right.
It's a wallaby.
It's a dingo, mate. So it was reported by several witnesses over a five-day period. And this is my favorite part of the whole thing. It was reported to have killed and partially devoured several animals, including ducks, geese, and a German Shepherd police dog, and other dogs. And what makes this so hysterical and fascinating is kangaroos are typically unaggressive and vegetarian.
Well, I think, though, that this is a case where you have them, you know, it was clearly a velociraptor.
Yeah.
And a thawed-out velociraptor.
Steven Spielberg did it.
And, you know, they didn't know what a velociraptor was, so they assumed it was a kangaroo.
Exactly. It's Tennessee. What do you expect? You know, and then in 1974...
Forget the clowns, everyone. Start dressing up as kangaroos. I'd like to see not just a kangaroo, but a kangaroo covered in that sort of, like, phosphorescent, you know, like the Hound of the Baskervilles. I want to see, like, kangaroo of the DuPonts or something, you know.
That would be hysterical. So in the 1970s, you had 74 and 78. 74, Chicago, Illinois had reports. Now, this was interesting because over the next month, from the ones that happened in Chicago, there were also sightings in Indiana and Wisconsin that occurred. Then there was a separate incident that occurred in 78 in Wisconsin. 2013, Oklahoma had a kangaroo sighting.
It's interesting because I think we've seen a lot of areas where in 1970, you know, how many Oklahomans had seen a kangaroo?
Exactly,
you know, like,
yes.
I don't even know what I'm looking at exactly, but I'm pretty sure it was a kangaroo.
Yes, and I think that's mainly what you're talking about. What's interesting is the 2013 one, where this, you know, says a kangaroo was reportedly recorded by hunters in a field. The video was published on website YouTube. We should see if we can find that. And promoted speculation that the animal may have been a pet kangaroo who went missing in the state just over a year earlier.
So, and it'll become a feral kangaroo living on its own.
Get him, boy, get him. And then there was a report also in 2013 in North Salem, New York. This one was apparently captured on video with what the person thought was a kangaroo and published the video on this individual's website. The newspaper noted that escaped wallabies, which are smaller than kangaroos,
were
known in Westchester County, which was part of North Salem. So, you know, this is a case where, and from all accounts, that seems to be what the myth is confirming with these other areas around the world, France, Japan, New Zealand, the UK. It's probably something where a zoo, you know, these animals, these creatures just escaped out, and that's what was seen.
Yeah, and then once one person's seen it, everybody's seen it.
Yes.
Though, you know, these things do happen. One time there was a guy chasing an emu with a UPS truck down Main Street in Bel Air, and that did actually happen. So sometimes it really is as weird as
it
all that.
It pans out.
Yeah.
That's great.
But yeah, we've gotten way off of the Slender Man. Though I think the phantom animals has always been an interesting to me, that sort of like cryptozoology, which encompasses, I mean, we need, you know, at least, we probably need our own podcast. We don't need it, but we need our own podcast for Bigfoot. I think someone, I think the Bigfoot Research Center, last I checked, was still following us on Twitter, so we need to hit them up and get them on to talk about Bigfoot. But some of the bigger named characters. But you know, in the field of cryptozoology, every once in a while, science does come forward and we find something that we thought was extinct, like the okapi and the coelacanth, the fish. Mm-hmm. And of course, that only helps fuel these ideas that they're still, you know, right. The sea monster thing. Chesapeake Bay has Chessie, and yes. So on and so forth. And Loch like Champlain has Champ. Cousin. Yeah, yeah. Like they're all sort of somehow ended up in all these different reservoirs and things like that. My favorite, I think, of all the, like, particularly get to the Bigfoot, are you familiar with the skunk ape?
I am not.
Okay, skunk ape, I think that this tends to be a southern thing, but I'm not sure. Again, it's basically a Lover's Lane monster. It's a Bigfoot, but it smells like horrible. Kind of like a skunk. So we've taken the Bigfoot, and it emits like skunk-like odors now. So, you know, if you're smelling like hot garbage and you're about to make out with somebody, right. It could be the skunk ape, or it could be bad hygiene. I'm not really sure which, but... I'm not quite sure how this came about, but it's definitely my favorite. In some of the versions, it definitely has like a big stripe on its back or something. Right. And I remember a few years ago, we went to the Maryland Film Festival, and they had a movie that was like Shake, Scream, Stomp or something that was basically like a, like, almost like one of those like beach movies from the 60s with right. musical numbers and a skunk ape chasing people around on the beach, kind of like Scooby-Doo.
Exactly what came to my mind when you said right. that.
You watch a skunk ape chase like a bunch of kids and Don Knotts down a hallway and down another hallway.
That's hysterical, man. Oh my word.
The skunk ape.
Yeah, that you know that every single guy who didn't shower before his date used that Sorry. As an excuse.
Wasn't me.
The skunk ape.
New Jersey had the Jersey Devil, of course, and that's a relatively popular one.
Yeah.
There was the Dover Demon, which was kind of related to, we get back to the UFO lore and mythology and things like that.
Yeah, New Hampshire has a couple of ones similar to that. You have the Wood Devils, which are, you know, variations of, you know, Bigfoot. Of course, Canada, you know, you've got the Wendigo. And then New Hampshire has one that's actually really interesting and can be even dated back as soon as 2001, where they thought they saw this thing, the New Hampshire Devil Monkey.
That's awesome because, you know, what's worse than a devil? The devil monkey.
Exactly. I mean,
get that devil monkey off your back.
And what's interesting is this thing looks like, did you ever see The Mummy 2 or The Mummy Returns?
With the little pygmy mummies?
Yeah, that's exactly what this thing looks like, is one of those little
pygmy things.
Oh,
wait, we have a picture?
Yes. Yes, oh, there is a picture.
Yeah, that's brilliant. You know, that was something I did love back in the day, was going to the grocery store and seeing The Inquirer, which was just really like, it was urban legends all day long. You know, Bat Boy found in a underground bunker or in the back of the Sam's Club or something, and now it's like where we've taken it and it's in a government lab somewhere. Yeah, all of these weird, weird stories. And I think, you know, one of the things as we go forward, like with the Pan Galaxy, is looking at how some of these stories, what's behind them and what started them. Like the microwave thing, the fear of technology, the ghost animals. It's just one of those things. Like you say, you see something and you have to have an explanation for it. Because what could it be? Because I probably didn't just see a mangy dog. I definitely saw a panther, you know.
Yes.
We have relatives and people who sometimes say, you know, definitely saw this thing and I can't explain it. It's like, well, maybe you saw something strange. Maybe maybe the neighbor with the Komodo dragon did get loose. But like, you know, a lot of times it's just like we always want to make the things that happen in our lives make sense.
Yes.
And that's what stories are for. Because even though it might not make logical sense to everybody else, at least I have an explanation.
Yes.
I feel much more relieved to know that I just saw a kangaroo.
Yes.
A phantom kangaroo than that my mind is playing tricks on me or something like that.
Yeah, no, and I think, you know, that's an excellent point. And, you know, what's interesting is a lot of, you know, what we're talking about, these things are called urban legends, but so many of them don't take place in the urban setting. And, you know, we have, what I find fascinating is like New York, one of their biggest urban legends, one of their biggest urban myths is the alligators in the sewers. And in fact, didn't they make like 4 or 5 movies based on that back in the 80s?
There were two. There was Alligator 1 and Alligator 2. Alligator 1 is, I haven't seen it in a long time, it's a kind of a fun movie where this little boy gets an alligator and he gets flushed down the toilet and it grows into a giant monster that's eventually like surfacing and eating people and it's just rampaging Godzilla style down the main street. Well, I think the thing with the urban legend that differs from the ghost story or the folk tale is there isn't a lot of difference except that the urban element, whether we're talking not necessarily the city, but it's the way that the story becomes spread. Because previous to that, the ghost story around the campfire, and you know, you look at something like the Paul Bunyan stories, like those were stories, and the Wendigo, stories are cultivated around campfire settings, but where you're really talking about not, like we, in an urban setting, go out to the woods.
Yes.
The woods don't come to us, we're not already in the woods. Lumber camps, they were there all the time, they were sharing stories, it was just a necessity part of life. The urban legends, I think it's more that they moved from the campfire.
Yes.
That now they were the story that gets told about the Lover's Lane or the and they encapsulated fears that were related to the modernization of the world. In fact, we're all closer together than we used to be. Yeah. So they're either fears about that one element that hasn't been modernized. The creepy house at the end of the street, the house that no one tears down, that still is dilapidated and old and creepy because it's bringing all our property values down and therefore it must be haunted. You know, that one place at the edge of town where no one goes because it's wooded and overgrown and it's not, it hasn't been perfectly paved, there's no astroturf yet, you know, those vestiges of things. Or some the kind of new seedy element we don't like. This is where I think a lot of the Satanist stuff comes in, like the kids who, the shifty kids on drugs, that kid there is on drugs. This is, and you know, on one hand, I'm telling stories that are kind of just in my mental database, and they've been leached, I think, of some of the gruesomeness, but some of these stories are kind of gruesome. And, you know, one of the big stories I remember, and my sister will tell you that I terrorized her with this for a while, was the story that involves the babysitter. The parents have found a babysitter for their young child, for their baby, and the babysitter shows up. Babysitter seems a little sketchy, but they don't want to have time to get another one. She's come recommended, so their mother's really concerned about it, but they leave. They haven't gone out in a while, so they go out. And mother gets a bad feeling and calls home and asks the babysitter how everything's going. She says, "It's going great, put the child down. And don't worry, I'm cooking a turkey in the oven for when you get home." And the parents are like, "Well, we're already at dinner, and we don't have a turkey." And of course, they go home and find that she's roasted the baby because she's strung out on drugs. Right. And that's a gross story.
Right.
I mean, that's a really gross story. and depending on how you tell it, it gets grosser. You know, they come in and they smell the roasting turkey and all that good stuff. But like, the obvious like fear there is the fear of that younger generation that we don't understand, that they're on drugs and you know, they're gonna destroy our youth and things like that, and that fear of like young people. And I remember there being people in our community growing up that like, "That guy's a Satanist because he wore a long dark coat," and I'm like, "No, he just, you know, he happens to like crappy rock music or something." I mean, no, it's Iron Maiden. It's not necessarily that he worships the devil.
Right.
You know, do you remember something classic that a big thing of the 80s was the backmasking? Do you remember that? Like the idea that on, in fact, a Flash episode just referenced the backmasking the other day.
Did you see the record?
Played the record backwards. And the idea was if you played the record backwards, you would hear some sort of message, some sort of little message. And you can do backmasking. And I'm sure some band probably heard this and was like, "Hey, that'd be a great idea." But I can't remember which rock band. But they interviewed a rock band. You know, it was probably one of the cheeky British ones. And they were asking about the backmasking. And he said, "Well, you know, do you really think that we would take the time to do all this effort and put a backmask message that said, 'Worship the devil'? Wouldn't it be more likely that we would say something like, 'Buy more Iron Maiden records' or something?" Our subliminal messages would just, you know, we're, so, but that's another thing, never really substantiated, but a lot of it, all those things, the candy, it's a fear of strange. The reason I think the urban element is now we're closer, and now we are so close in some cases to people who, I mean, right now, there's people on that side of the wall. How well do I really know them?
Yes.
And this, I live in a townhouse, so I'm not talking about my other family members.
Right.
There's people on that side. How well do I know them?
Exactly.
And in that case, we're so close that there's a certain element of mistrust. I think it's what breeds the urban legend, takes the ghost story out of it. And
Well, so much so that, you know, you had an entire movie revolve around that with the Burbs. Tom Hanks.
Burbs. Oh, yeah. The couple movies. I did one with Neighbors with Jim Belushi and Dan Aykroyd back in the 80s. The Burbs is a great movie.
Yeah. But, I mean, that's, you know, that's what it all revolves around is, man, you know, there are these people. I don't know them. And, you know, he has all sorts of weird dreams, you know, that they're Satanists and, you know, they're mass murderers and, you know, all this stuff. Now, well, they do turn out to be.
And his neighbor, Art Weingartner, even turns. Well, they do. But at the same time, the neighbors are still as excessively weird as anybody else in that movie.
Yes.
But his neighbor Art does tell him a story about the ice cream man that murdered people and things like that. That's a fun movie. It's on Netflix now. I highly recommend that.
Oh, yes.
It's the last minute Halloween viewing. There's some good stuff for you. Yeah, there are tons of stories that kind of revolve around that. And again, you do have the other babysitter story, which is the one where the babysitter is there with the kids and she keeps getting phone calls.
Mm-hmm.
They're telling her, I'm going to be here soon and things like that. And eventually, when she calls the operator and has them track the number, they say the call is coming from inside the house. Yeah. And the guy is somewhere in a room calling her. And, you know, that's another one that preys on these different fears and a little bit of the technology thing too.
What's interesting with that though is that has actually come to pass a little bit, because what telemarketers can do now is they can for some reason they can actually use your number to call with your house. So, like, you know, Joy's been sitting in the house and like she's received a call from Nathan Bell, which is it's like, you know, the first few times that happened.
I see what
you're saying.
I was like, okay, so let me see where this is
going. Yeah, the first few times that happened, she was like, what is going on?
It's like
on
when you receive the email from yourself.
Yes, exactly.
You're like, oh, my email has been corrupted.
You know, so it's interesting, though, because these urban myths, these ghost stories, they are designed to... They're designed to get a reaction out of us, just like the horror movie. They're designed to get a scare. They're designed to get the jump, whatever, you know, whatever it might be.
And I think there's a certain level where they're sort of exercising something too. That's not exercise. I avoid that.
Right.
But when I mean, and I'm not talking about the a literal exorcism,
right?
But rather anxieties and fears and stuff. Mm-hmm. We all feel a little bit better about them when we put them in sort of some context. And I think it's interesting, too, that a lot of the urban legends we're talking about, like, at their heart, there's a plausibility, but there's also a certain silliness to them.
Yes.
Like, there's a point where an urban legend is almost a form of satire of our own fears and of our own society. Like, even the clown thing happening right now, like, the absurdity of that element is... The reason people are dressing up like clowns, we don't really know, but it's not because it's advantageous to attack people, because it's a clown.
Everyone's like, on high alert.
Right. Well, and that's the thing, too, is in reality, the person we should probably be most worried about is the nondescript person standing on the edge of the playground who's there and is just sort of wandering about, and maybe seems like they should be there. You know what I mean? Like, and I'm not telling anyone to worry about anything, but I'm just saying that, like, in a context... The reality when someone is often kidnapped. If a clown took your kid, everyone just saw a clown run across the street with somebody. A clown standing at the edge of the playground is there for one reason: for you to look at them and see them. But that's kind of the element of the urban legend: to look and to see. Like the story when the creepy killer, for instance, is in a story. They're not just a nondescript person. They have the hook on the hand, or they're the skunk ape or something. There's some overly embellished element to the story that adds that element of unreality. That's the sigh of relief a little bit. Like, well, that's just ridiculous. You know, that's like the calls inside the house. Well, you know, and the killers, how did they get there? And like one of the reasons the story is not more realistic is so it scares you, but in the light of day, it looks ridiculous. I mean, that's why I don't think we're taking great lengths to explain why is the killer trying to cut your head off while the car is still running.
Because once you break it down and analyze it, it doesn't make logical sense.
No. But we talked a little about local legends. We could talk about the Slender Man in a second. Local legends for me, I know that we had, growing up in Harford County, not too far from where I used to live, there was the Ghost of Peddler's Run, which is more of your traditional ghost story in the sense that, you know, you've got a bridge where a peddler back in the day, and again, back in the day is quite a while back, you know, who's taking his wares and selling them in towns here and there, and he's walking on foot. So you've got a context where everybody's far apart. This guy's probably traveling during the night, and someone comes upon him, cuts his head off, throws it into the bushes, and steals all his stuff. Now, of course, just like you had iterated with the other story, someone who is just going to take your stuff doesn't need to cut your head off. That's a lot of extra time and effort, and then to go and throw it. So the people who try to find like the reality is like, well, it must have been someone he knew, you know.
Yes.
But who's going to take the time to remove the head?
That's right.
But of course, the head gets thrown away, and now the peddler is still there in that same spot, wandering around and looking for his head. And that's that classic ghost story. The ghost story element where you've got the disembodied thing looking for something. The golden arm story where someone cuts off the arm and the ghost is looking for it.
Right.
So you have that element of like the lost body part or the lost whatever, and the ghost is searching for it. It's a creepy image, I guess, because again, like you talk about the reality of it. You can make up a story about a killer hiding by a bridge, but you know, maybe that's a little too close for comfort. The idea of seeing a headless ghost is kind of enticing, you know? Yes. Like, I could probably want to see it for a couple minutes, but not a lot. I don't want to really look at it too long.
I want to throw Casper and Dean in front of that ghost.
Yeah, just right. I could kind of see it for a few minutes, but I don't want to, like, look down the, like, stump or anything.
Yes.
And, you know, so there's that element of creepiness and otherworldliness to it. But I think after a while, these things become almost familiar. Like, it's a way to make your area where you live a little more interesting. Like,
it's
a familiar landmark. Hey, you know, I'm not out here by myself. I got the ghost.
That's right.
You know, we've
come
got...
see.
Yes, right. Cecil County has the pig woman, which... I know, right? You get kind of hard up for character. Don't laugh. Come on, don't make fun of this. Which is, you know, there are varying stories here, but essentially she's also a lover's lane kind of monster, but there's differing stories. There's also St. George's County has the goat man, you know, where the llama boy is out there somewhere. And, but you know, the reminds me of the goat guy off of SNL,
yes.
Like goat boy who would just, meh, yeah, exactly. Bleat all the time. But pig woman, not to be confused with Miss Piggy, in some versions of the story, she's not literally a woman with a pig's head, but in some of the stories, it'd be like, forget it, she has a pig's head and hooves. Yes, exactly, and she's kind of running around. But in some of the stories, she's been the result of a horrible disfigurement and burning or something, and so she's running around, and she's deranged now, and she's killing kids.
Yeah.
And again, based around a bridge in Elkton, I think in some stories where it's Pig Woman Bridge. You know, all these things have a landmark, because I guess they just get comfortable. And like.
Right.
It's the big woman. She lives down under the bridge by the river. And so these stories... But the funny thing about the pig woman is that the things that she does, the stories she's known for are, you know, the kids go up to a certain space, a certain place near the bridge to make out or to, you know, tell stories about the pig woman. And they get out of the boyfriend gets out of the car. And then the girl is so afraid because... she hears a noise, and it's banging against the car, and she doesn't know what it is, and she eventually realizes it's her boyfriend's feet. He's been killed.
Yes.
And, I mean, we've heard that story all over the place, but it now belongs to the pig woman of Cecil County. So all those stories, they tend to be very similar. They have. So I don't think many of us go around thinking that there's shreds of reality here. It's just, it's like an easy template. You know, it's like Mad Libs. You take it and you lay onto it what you need.
Yeah, no, and you know, it's funny because I was looking through some of New England's, you know, myths and things like that and legends, and what's fascinating is there aren't a lot that revolve around New Hampshire. I mean, there's the whole, you know, psychotic, you know, devil monkey thing.
I love the devil monkey, by the way. I don't actually love the devil monkey. I like the concept.
That's right. But most of them are actually take place in the Massachusetts, Connecticut areas where you had the witch trials going on. And so there's a lot of mysticism that goes on with that. You have the witches. There's lures of vampires in those areas. And, I mean, I'm sure New Hampshire has its own fair share, but New Hampshire just tends to, like, group itself with the whole New England community and pull from their sources and somehow make it their own. So all of these would be variations of, you know, of others, the Witches of Bristol, which is, you know, apparently one of the last major witch hunts that occurred in New England. And, you know, there's the ruins of Hanton City, which is in Rhode Island, and Vermont's got its own stone chambers and, you know, creepy little things.
And I think that kind of, that's the interesting thing about New England, in the sense that areas that have a relative, like everything being relative, a relatively recent set of tragedies, mm-hmm. and American tragedies in a sense, being the witch trials, you know, this yes. giant kind of mark on history. The South, you know, certainly has with some of the more
Civil War.
Civil War, things like that. There's different places that have, because of certain traumatic events in history, a certain area is sort of like becomes tied to that.
Yes.
And what in being tied, you know, Gettysburg doesn't need a skunk ape because
right.
it has plenty of its own ghost stories.
Right.
And Gettysburg is a wonderful place to go for ghost stories. Every yes. inn in Gettysburg is haunted. Every McDonald's in Gettysburg is probably haunted. Certainly the bathrooms are. But there are these areas where they don't need, you know, Baltimore, Maryland, maybe we're a little boring. We have to create our, you know.
Because you guys just have regular old killers.
Wisconsin has to make up a phantom kangaroo because it's
right.
kind of thin. But, you know, in an area like New England where you have this very rich sort of historical scar, in a sense,
yes.
That's ripe for still drawing on things. I mean,
yeah.
you will always have these witch stories, and some of them are predicated by maybe a sense of, not necessarily founded, but a sense of, like, community or societal guilt. Not real
yes.
guilt, but a certain sense of shame.
Sure.
It's like, we got this thing in our history,
sure.
and, you know, those areas that have the kind of haunt of slavery on them, you know, the
yes.
same thing. It can be any number of things. But it gives them a little bit of character. That's one of the things that's interesting about Europe. Europe has such a rich history. It's so, a lot of its history is much older.
Yes.
And so therefore it has a lot of different spooky stories
yes.
and things to pull from. And the urban legends are probably dissipated in favor of the really old
yes.
stuff.
Yeah, and, you know, one of my favorite places that I've been, and I'd love to go back and take joy at some point, is Scotland. Scotland is just
right. Which has a really huge
yes.
and ancient history in regards to myths and legends and
yes.
things like that. And you've got the boggarts and the shades
yes.
and the kelpies and all those different kinds of things.
And it's so perfect with the setting. You have the highlands and you have the fog that literally just kind of rolls in and over, and so there's can be a real sense of foreboding that goes on there, and what is the fog bringing to us?
Yeah, and you're right, you get those, again, that big element of the ghost stories. And I think it was interesting because growing up, my for a large chunk of my young life, we lived in a house with my grandmother and grandfather, who both were born and had their roots in North Carolina. And, of course,
mm-hmm.
North Carolina, if you look back at North Carolina historically, when you had immigrants coming over, particularly from the Highlands or places
mm-hmm.
like that, a lot of them migrated to the area that would be closest to what they were familiar with.
Yeah.
So there were a lot of Scottish people who kind of relocated to areas of North Carolina, areas of the mountains
yeah.
that were reminiscent of what's the closest thing I can get, you know.
Yeah.
And so those areas tend to also be very full and ripe with ghost stories that very much resemble
yes.
what you would find in the old country, stories involving
yes.
ghostly stories of vengeance. Big thing, my grandmother used to tell me the creepiest story, and pretty sure she heard from her father, and it's very similar to a lot of other stories, but it was so creepy, involving a spectral dog. Spectral dogs are a thing,
yes.
the harbinger of death.
Yes.
That if you see a black dog, or in some cases a white dog,
yes.
But very rarely a black and white spotted dog, you know, like one of the 101 Dalmatians, but that some dogs are a sign of death or a
yes.
harbinger of doom. And the story typically goes that whatever animal this is shows up, and it's a portent of someone's about to die.
Yes.
And she tells a story involving her father, who is with someone who's sick, and they run to get help, and on their way they see what they think is a white sheet blow down into the center of the road in front of them, but when they look again, it's not a sheet, it's a dog that is sort of just, you know, because dogs blow in all the time on the wind. And when they approach it, it has all those weird qualities. It's growling, it has red eyes, you know. And then by the time they return back home, or they get back to the ailing person, that person is dead.
Yes.
And so they've made the connection now between the ghostly dog and the person who's dead.
Yes.
And I'm sure there have been many circumstances where someone who is in the midst of something like this sees something that they interpret as a sign.
Yeah.
And there were a lot of stories like that, that where the ghostly element or the supernatural element was not so much an attacker or the killer or the usurper, but was a sign of, you know, that death happens regardless, and the supernatural element is like a portent of that.
Yes. Yeah. No, that's so true. You know, I think sometimes in America we forget how blended we truly are, you know, and so whether, you know, there are things coming over from the UK, or whether our stories are coming over from, you know, Europe, or whether they're born here in America from Native American legend and folklore, you know, or a combination of all of it.
Which is where the Wendigo derives from, ultimately, and which is a really interesting legend of stuff. Or it comes over, you know, with the Mexican sewer rats, which was another classic urban. Are you familiar with that?
It sounds familiar,
It was one in the 80s that sort of, I think, was sort of that poking fun at the American xenophobia, where an American family goes on vacation in Mexico, and they bring their daughter back, a chihuahua, and the chihuahua's acting really weird, and the little girl's getting freaked out, and they call the vet, and the vet comes and is like, this is a Mexican sewer rat, and it has rabies. And, you know, so part of that story is like the ridiculousness of the Americans. But then, really, I mean, you know, you got a couple of Trump elements here, because it's like the Mexicans, like, we bring this nice, cute thing in, but it's really, you know, there's a dark, sinister angle to it. It's not what we thought, and now it's in our home, you know. It's a pretty messed up story, but...
Man, that's crazy. You know, it's interesting. I want to talk about Slender Man, and I've kind of pulled up some ghost stories or legends, and I, you know, like to maybe finish off with one of these, so... Let's go ahead and talk about the Slender Man here.
So, for anyone who's not that familiar, I mean, and most of us probably are, the internet is just rife with lots of ways in which things can pop up now. And then, like, there are websites, Reddit is a big site, where anywhere where you've got people with the ability to sort of start sharing things in a community with a lot of quick response time, you know, where I can post something and then you can post a response to my thing. By the end of the day, you may start out at 10 a.m. this morning, you started with a single line, and by the night, I've got an entire story going that you and I are pitching as something real. The weird thing about the Slender Man mythology is that it in no way was ever really intended to be taken seriously, I don't think. The first, and I could be a little off on this, I think the first interaction with the Slender Man thing was a post on either Reddit or Creepypasta or one of those sites where there's just an image. And do you have the image, Nathan? Have you found it, the Slender Man picture?
Yeah, this right here.
No. Oh, there's okay. One that, if you look up Slender Man and like the classic image, there's a picture that shows a bunch of kids on a playground. And it's a photograph, and they're all walking towards the camera. So the child that's closest to the camera is kind of staring with a weird, dazed look in their eye. And the rest of the children seem to be following him. So in reality, it's probably just a picture of children lining up and coming back in from, like, recess or something.
Sure.
But there's a weird kind of creepy Village of the Damned quality to the way these kids are kind of amassing. And the playground is in the background. And sort of in the background of this image, it's kind of clearly been photoshopped, but there is a dark, tall, creepy figure that kind of resembles Jack Skellington from Nightmare Before Christmas a little bit, and looks like he has tentacles kind of sprouting out of his limbs, like beyond. He has arms, but he also seems to have these other protrusions. He's a creepy, ghostly looking thing, and he's in the shot, and he's far behind the children. The children are coming towards us in the picture, and there's a line that says something. That's the picture right there. See, it's very, very creepy, and you've got these kids, and the kid in the foreground is a very suspicious look, and in the background you can't quite make it out, but there's a thing with its arms outstretched, and this had a line of dialogue beneath it that said something like, you know, we tried to resist him, but his voice was in our heads, and he made us do the terrible thing, or something to that effect. So one of the cool things about something like that, someone just created a whole mythology and a story just with that one image and that one line.
Sure.
And it sparked a whole thing. And then there's a group called Marble Hornets, which made a film, a short film. It was a series of short films online that delved into the mythology of this Slender Man. Had a group of people that started finding it was invading their dreams, and it's a monster, and it's related somehow to the children, and it influences people. It wasn't super original. It was taking a lot of different elements from all over the place and melding them together into a kind of internet character. What happens eventually, though, is it becomes sort of popular. People know about the Marble Hornets. And I think we can trace a Slender Man back. We were joking about the Blair Witch earlier, but Blair Witch was a good example of sort of a really interesting, like, kind of coalescence of urban legends and marketing and things like that to tell a story that no one really believed, but then kind of did for a short period of time and then didn't believe again. But it set the precedent, I think, for how information is disseminated across the internet in regards to legends and myths. Mm-hmm. So the Slender Man thing happens, and then we have two girls murder a third girl in reality. There's even a documentary, I think, about this called The Slender Man Murders. And now, what's really going on here, I'm not entirely certain. I mean, I can be pretty certain that the Slender Man didn't cause anyone to kill anybody. Not legitimately, in actuality. But these two girls murder a third girl. And they actually are... They go forward saying the Slender Man wanted them to kill somebody. Mm. And that it requested that they do this. And that... regardless of whether they're just trying to sort of aim for an insanity plea or they get caught up in this game in their own head, I have no idea. But it adds a very strange and sort of like somber dimension to something that has up to this point just been purely a folktale. And yet in some ways now the Slender Man has more reality than some of the 80s stories we hear, because in the 80s stories no one actually ever did get murdered. But now we have somebody who's been killed in the name of the Slender Man, regardless of what the motive ultimately is. So I think that's a very strange... And we see the kind of thing with the clowns, where the internet or the community that exists now purposely creates this thing. They're not using it as a way to just sort of like exercise social anxieties. They're making something that they're putting out there, and then sort of through force of will in some cases... making it a real thing, like the clown idea. Like, yes. There was no army of clowns that just popped up one day. Through a continued force of will, people made that clown thing a thing.
Yes.
And I think that's interesting, because I don't think that's the way that the original urban legends were birthed. They were something that sprung out of a anxiety. Sometimes we didn't know they were there until they were there. And there wasn't necessarily an effort to make them real. They were what they were. They were ways to explain things. But now it seems almost be in reverse. We get the legends after we manifest, we make the monster.
Yes. No, I think that's completely fair. And, you know, it's fascinating, because when I'm on Facebook, a lot of times I'll, you know, come up to the, you know, Reddit things or whatever it is there, and they'll have the lists of, you know, scary moments or, you know, people who swear these, you know, things happen to them. And
top 30 things I can make up on a slow news
exactly,
day.
Exactly, exactly. You know, interestingly enough, I found a website. You know, I mean, you don't have to go far to find a site. This is off of Huffington Post. And these are 12 terrifying ghost stories you shouldn't read alone. This one, I mean, it's the first one up there. It's called The Cell Phone. It's short, so, you know.
I'm who wrote these? Did the editor of the website write these stories?
You know, I don't know. What I'm going to say is yes, and somebody else can fact check that.
Most likely, yes, indeed.
So this one's called The Cell Phone. A couple months ago, my friend's cousin, a single mother, so I love this start of this combination. First of all, it's a friend's cousin, and she's a single mother.
So the vulnerability is there. We've got the realistic tie and the vulnerability.
Exactly. So She bought a new cell phone after a long day of work. She came
That's horrifying. That could be the end of the story. He bought a new cell phone and didn't know how to use it.
If it was the Galaxy 7, it could be a horrible story. So she came home from work, put the cell phone on the counter, went to watch TV. Her son came down and asked if he could play with her new phone. She told him not to call anyone or mess with the text messages, and he agreed. Around 11:20, she was drowsy, so she decided to tuck her son in and go to bed. She walked to his room and saw that he wasn't there. She then ran over to her room to find him sleeping on her bed with the phone in hand. Relieved, she picked back up her phone from his hand to inspect it. Browsing through it, she noticed only minor changes, such as new background, new banner, so on and so forth. But then she decided to delete the pictures he had taken. So she began going through them one at a time and deleting them one after the other. Then there was a picture, the last picture on there, she looked through, and when she saw it, she was in disbelief. It was her son sleeping on her bed, but the picture was taken by someone else above him, and it showed the left half of an elderly woman's face. So essentially this selfie of him and
now did they go on and put this on social media? And on the ghost Twitterer.
That's right.
You see that? Hey guys, this is where I died. LOLZ.
Hey, it brings a whole new meaning to Ghost Rider, man.
Right. Well, we had the ghost whisperer. The ghost Twitterer would be great. Somebody who tries to help people do their unfinished business through tweets. I can solve this in a minute. Let me just pull up Google Maps. We'll find your long lost mother, and then you can go to the everlasting peace.
I tweet dead people.
Yes, I am.
Oh, that's great. But, you know, again, as we...
Hanging out with Hoffa, yo. This has potential. A ghost Twitterer. This could be its own podcast.
That's right. We've got to explore this more.
Exploit is what you mean.
Well, that too. We have to explore it more so we can exploit it.
Fair enough.
But, no, I mean... You know, again, what we talked about, you know, in this very short little story, I think a lot of these elements that we've talked about are there, playing on the fears. Again, you have this plausible connection that we talked about at the beginning, you know, this friend's cousin.
I was waiting to find out that it was someone else's phone, like Robert Downey Jr. fell asleep in your kid's bed, and it's actually his phone.
And he's right there, ready to get it.
Yeah, right. There's just pictures of him wearing the Iron Man suit at home. What's going on?
Oh, that's awesome. But, you know, you have the image of, again, you have the single mother and the child. And, you know, it starts out a little creepy because she goes up and he's not in his room. Where is he? Okay, he's in my room. So starts looking through. And then, you know, this person has been invaded, you know, by this spirit or whatever.
We've got it so much easier now because we have like a wealth of horror movies to pull from. Yes. I mean, this is essentially a scene from a horror movie. There's a movie out now, I'm not even sure if it's on DVD yet, but should be soon, called Lights Out. It kind of deals with the idea of when the lights go out, this thing, this spectral force appears. And that is pretty creepy and definitely deals with that urban legend kind of feel.
Yeah. Well, again, what's so fun and fascinating about this is there's the element of excitement because, you know, you're sitting here, you're listening to this story. Again, it's playing with your emotions. There's something in this that's pulling and drawing on you. But again, there's also something that when you think about it in the light of day, it is quite silly. The logic of it is ridiculous. But when you're in that moment... It's nighttime. Again, the shadows are behind you. You can't see someone coming up from behind. You know, you're encircled. You're relying on your friends and company who are in front of you to shed some light on your safety if somebody's coming behind you or not. And of course, they're not going to do it because they're trying to scare the stuffing out of you. And, you know, so there's that element of vulnerability, as we said at the beginning, that is going on and at play, that is happening at night around the campfire with people that, you know, if we were to try to do the same thing when it's, you know, 2 o'clock in the afternoon on a bright sunny day, just wouldn't have that same effect and appeal.
And I have the last thing I kind of want to mention about this is, I don't know about you growing up, but like, when I was growing up, there was kind of an element. My family, we were big storytellers, and we liked to tell stories. Mm. But there was a feeling, too, and I think this even happens sometimes with the horror movies, where, well, don't tell anyone too scary a story. We don't want to scar you. You know, I hear so much about, well, this scarred me or that scarred me. I mean, growing up, I saw some creepy things, some things that did stick in my head. I heard creepy stories that stuck in my head.
Sure.
But, you know, I never really, I don't think, and not this can't happen, but, I mean, you know, I was never scarred. There was never, I never had any therapy that was necessary. Yeah. In fact, I would go as far to say, at least when we're talking about the telling of stories, I think you have to be mindful of the audience and the age and everything. But I think, you know, I would encourage people that telling stories can be a really fun way, sometimes of dealing with anxiety, dealing with fears, dealing even with someone who's afraid of the dark. You would not think that the best thing to do would be to tell ghost stories. And maybe it isn't, but I mean, there's a sense of, if you were to go and be in the dark, I remember that some of us were kind of freaked out of the dark as young kids. And I remember there was a kind of a game you play where you could run to the end of the hallway and tap the door and come back. And could you do that? Because you're running into the pure dark and you don't know. But every time your hand would touch the door, you never touched a grotesque face. Yes. You never touched something. Except for the time that the dog was down there. I didn't know it. That was terrifying. But you know that most of the time, there's that reassurance. You put your hand out into the unknown and it touches the wall. Right. And maybe not every time it will, but over a certain amount of time, you realize that fear of the dark is irrational, because by the time you've touched the horrible face, by the time you've encountered the unknown thing, it doesn't matter anymore. You wasted all that time being afraid.
Yes.
And I think there's value. There can be value in telling stories and kind of embracing this sort of creepy pastime a little bit.
Right. And I think, too, part of what's intriguing about many of these stories is the lack of a satisfactory resolution. You know, when we talk
usually people die.
Yeah, I mean really. And I think that's different from the ancient stories of the myths and the legends, where there was a hero who came in to fight the darkness, to fight the evil, and was victorious and conquered it. There is something unique about the ghost story where there isn't necessarily a satisfactory resolution. We have to base ourselves back into reality to get that satisfactory resolution.
Sometimes the ghost doesn't go away, or if the, you know, that the overall haunting thing about the stories is, again, it's two things: the unknown and it's like death.
Yes.
The Blair Witch Project was not scary because there was a witch involved, which is what the filmmakers of the new movie failed to understand.
Yes.
But it was scary because the primal thing in the Blair Witch Project, the movie, is the fear of being lost in the woods. Yes. And if you're anyone who's ever hiked, who's ever done any kind of walking in the woods for a long time, you get to that point when you've lost a sense of where you are, the sun is starting to go down, and there's that weird thing in the back of your head of, what if I don't get out of here in time? Yeah. What if I'm still here and I don't know where I'm at when the sun goes down?
Yes.
And that, to me, was what was freaky about the Blair Witch Project, not anything else per se.
Right. Well, and again, I think that's, you know, our base nature. We are terrified of the unknown. You know, there is a base instinct in us to live. You know, you talk to people who survived war. You talk to people who survived traumatic experiences. Many times people who try to commit suicide often fail, because within us there is a drive to live. So this concept of death is a foreign, unknown, scary concept, even though it's something we're surrounded with all the time. But for us personally, those are some of the elements that play on our fears.
Yeah, I'd be interested in hearing from anyone who's listening about your own personal urban legends that you heard growing up, or that were maybe specific to your area, or even things that you've encountered even more recently on the internet. Your best spooky story, your best urban tale, whatever you've got out there. Let's hear it. I'd love to hear it. And you can either leave those in the messages on our Facebook page or our Twitter page, or on... you can actually leave them in the comment section on the Podbean site.
Yes.
Or you can email us, and that's at popcultninja at gmail.com. And yeah, we would love to hear from you, particularly about this. And as we go forward again with the Phantom Galaxy, planning to explore more about individual urban legends and things like that. I'd love to collect some stories, too. I think that'd be cool to hear people telling stories, because that was a big thing, again, in the 80s. I mentioned some of these anthologies, like Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark. There was an author named Daniel Cohen who had a book called Southern Fried Rat and Other Stories. So things like that were always fun. One last one, Nathan, for you here, if you've ever heard this particular one. The people who buy a car, and when they open the trunk up, it's just horribly grotesque because somebody has died in the trunk of this car.
I have not heard that
I've encountered relatives, again, North Carolina, that would swear that someone bought a car and they opened it up and it's just funky because somebody has let somebody, I don't know how this even happened, right, sort of deteriorate in the back of the car and didn't bother to clean it up. And then eventually his car just ends up back at the shop to get bought. And sometimes it involves the element of the back seat ghost, where you look in the rearview mirror and there's a person sitting back there. And when you turn around, they're not there. They only exist in the rearview mirror, which seems like a very Twilight Zone thing to do. And eventually they learn that someone did die in the back of the car. So,
well, I'm about to get in my car and drive off, so I'll let you know if there are any ghosts back there.
No problem. Check everything. You don't, the thing behind you will do it for you.
Hey, buddy, can you see what's back
there? Yes, right. Take a look. Come on, Skunk Ape. Yeah, that's right. Something. All right. Good night, everyone. All right, take care. See ya.